The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the March-April 2024 issue. We begin with our cover story, A History of Solar Eclipses. Eclipses have held sway over humanity since long before we knew what these events truly were. As humans have evolved on Earth, many naturally occurring events, earthquakes, volcanoes, destructive weather, have struck fear into their hearts. At the top of the list, though, may be the disappearance of the life-giving sun from the midday sky during a total solar eclipse. Even today, the drama of such phenomena compels people to travel halfway across the globe to witness them. But which eclipses throughout history are the most noteworthy? For this list, I have chosen to include eclipses you might not be familiar with, including many that happened before the invention of the telescope. As you read through them, particularly the earliest accounts, try to imagine standing in darkness beneath the moon's shadow for a few fleeting minutes, which, in the minds of those terrified souls, must have seemed much longer. Our first entry is the earliest solar eclipse for which we have a record. The account appears in the ancient Chinese text Shu Jing, traditionally said to have been compiled by the philosopher Confucius, which reads, "On the first day of the last month of autumn, the sun and moon did not meet harmoniously in Fang." What an understated way to describe an eclipse. Pinning the exact date of this event is somewhat problematic. Originally, scholars stated that it occurred either in 2136 BCE or 2128 BCE. The mention of Fang, though, ultimately holds the key. This term refers to a section of the sky mainly in Scorpius. Furthermore, we know the eclipse happened during the reign of Zhang Kang, an emperor of the Chia dynasty. Based on these details, the only eclipse that could have been seen from the capital city was October 22nd, 2137 BCE. There's also a long-standing tale, which may be true but probably isn't, about this eclipse and two royal astrologers, He and Ho. In at least one version, they were drunk prior to the event and didn't warn the emperor that the eclipse was coming. Whether or not they even knew it was coming is debatable. Long story short, they reportedly were killed for their mistake. Our next entry is recorded in the Shi Jing, a collection of ancient poetry whose compilation is also credited to Confucius. The eclipse in question occurred during the Zhou dynasty, though the exact date is uncertain. Some astronomers have pointed to the total eclipse of June 4th, 781 BCE, though this would have only been a partial eclipse in Zhou territory. Another candidate is the eclipse of November 30th, 735 BCE, which was annular in the western Zhou capital of Hao, near modern-day Xi'an. About the same time in Greece, Plutarch wrote about an annular eclipse that occurred around the death of Romulus in 716 BCE. Such an eclipse happened December 10th. The path of annularity crossed northern Africa, while in Athens, a bit more than one-third of the sun was obscured by the moon. More than a century later, a total solar eclipse on May 28, 585 BCE, might have ended a war between the Lydians and the Medes. Greek historian Herodotus wrote about the conclusion of the conflict in Book 1 of his Histories. As the balance had not inclined in favor of either nation, another engagement took place in the sixth year of the war, in the course of which, just as the battle was growing warm, day was suddenly turned into night. When the Lydians and Medes observed the change, they ceased fighting and were alike anxious to conclude peace. A later solar eclipse had a similar effect when it cast a shadow on a conflict over Corinth between the Spartans, led by Cleombrotus, and the invading Persians, led by Xerxes I. Herodotus wrote that while Cleombrotus was offering sacrifice to know if he should march out against the Persians, the sun was suddenly darkened in mid-sky. As you might imagine, some 2,500 years ago, eclipses were not seen as good omens. This one, which astronomers now think occurred October 2nd, 480 BCE, rattled Cleombrotus and caused a full retreat of the Spartan forces. Nearly half a century later, a solar eclipse nearly stopped the army of Athens from attacking the Spartans. In his History of the Peloponnesian War, Greek historian Thucydides writes, "In the same summer, at the beginning of a new lunar month, at which time alone this phenomenon seems possible, the sun was eclipsed after midday and became full again after it had assumed a crescent form and after some of the stars had shone out. This eclipse best matches one on August 3rd, 431 BCE, from northern Greece. The moon would have covered more than 91% of the sun. The stars that shone out were almost certainly Venus, which was 20 degrees from our daytime star, and Jupiter, which was twice as far away from the eclipsed sun." Shortly after BCE became CE, a record of a notable solar eclipse comes to us from a work titled Contra Celsum by the theologian Origen of Alexandria. In it, he writes of an eclipse that occurred during the reign of Tiberius Julius Caesar Augustus. He states that there was the greatest eclipse of the sun, and also that it became night in the sixth hour of the day, or noon, so that stars even appeared in the heavens. There was a great earthquake in Bithynia, and many things were overturned in Nicaea. This event transpired November 24th in the year 29. Some theologians have speculated that this eclipse may have caused the darkness, as described in the Bible, during the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. However, the eclipse was not total from Jerusalem. In other words, not nearly dark enough to be described as darkness. Additionally, many Christian scholars suspect the crucifixion occurred later, likely in either the year 30 or 33, and that the reported darkness may have been caused by a massive dust storm rather than a solar eclipse. The eclipse on March 20th in the year 71 stands out because in a book titled De Face in Orbe Lunae, On the Face Which Appears in the Orb of the Moon, the Greek philosopher Plutarch described the corona. This outer atmosphere of the sun had doubtless been seen during hundreds of total solar eclipses prior, but Plutarch was the first to write of it, saying, "Even if the moon, however, does sometimes cover the sun entirely, the eclipse does not have duration or extension, but a kind of light is visible about the rim, which keeps the shadow from being profound and absolute." After Plutarch's account, it would take another 266 years before someone described another solar feature seen during an eclipse. That happened when a member of the Roman Senate, Julius Firmicus Maternus, authored the earliest description of a prominence. His observation is even more remarkable because the July 17, 334 event was an annular eclipse, and he wasn't even in the path of annularity. He watched it from Sicily, where it was an 88% partial eclipse. July 19, 418, marks the first total solar eclipse of which we have a record, during which a comet was seen. Turkish-born church historian Philostorgius wrote in Book 12 of the Epitome Historiae Ecclesiastae, "When Theodosius had reached adolescence, on the 19th of July, at about the eighth hour, the sun was so completely eclipsed that stars appeared. There appeared in the sky with the sun, while in eclipse, a cone-shaped light, which came out of ignorance called a comet. But it showed none of the features of a comet, for the light did not form a tail, nor was it at all like a star. Rather, it resembled a great lamp flame appearing on its own with no star under it to form a wick for it. Its movement was also different. It began where the sun rises at the equinox, from there passed over the last star in the bear's tail, and went on slowly westward." Clearly, Philostorgius did not believe the object was a comet. Many reports from China and Europe, however, prove that it was. So the event goes down as the first reports of a comet seen during the total eclipse of a solar eclipse, during the total phase of a solar eclipse. The first famous total solar eclipse after the year 1000 was on August 2nd, 1133. Visible in Scotland, totality was nearly 4.5 minutes in length. And this eclipse provides just one of many historical examples of people wrongly associating a celestial spectacle with an earthly event. In his Historia Novella, written between 1140 and 1143, English historian William of Malmesbury links this eclipse with the death of King Henry I. The elements manifested their sorrow at this great man's last departure from England. For the sun on that day was the sixth hour, shrouded his glorious face, as the poets say, in hideous darkness, agitating the hearts of men by an eclipse. And on the sixth day of the week, early in the morning, there was so great an earthquake that the ground appeared absolutely to sink down, a horrid noise being first heard beneath the surface. The problem is that the eclipse and the death occurred in different years. The account implies, 19th century author Mabel Loomis Todd writes in her book Total Eclipse of the Sun, that Henry must have died in 1133, which he did not, or else there must have been an eclipse in 1135, which there was not. But this is not the only labyrinth into which chronology and old eclipses, imagination and computation lead the unwary searcher. Quite true. For now, we'll stay in Scotland. The next three total solar eclipses are memorable because of the nicknames the Scottish people gave them. The June 17, 1433 eclipse's totality lasted up to 4 minutes and 26 seconds. It is remembered as the Black Hour. On March 7, 1598, a total eclipse, known as Black Saturday, had a duration of totality of 1 minute 29 seconds in the southeastern part of the country. Finally, Merc Monday refers to the eclipse that occurred April 8, 1652. In Edinburgh, the residents experienced 2 minutes and 47 seconds of totality. More fleeting was the hybrid solar eclipse, one that is annular at one or both ends of the path and total in the middle, of January 24, 1544. Totality lasted a mere 16.3 seconds. Dutch mathematician Gemma Frisius observed this event as a 95% partial eclipse from Belgium. Later, he published what may be the first illustration of a camera obscura, a darkened room with a hole, later versions used a lens, at one end that projects an image from outside onto the wall. Frisius' illustration shows the eclipse projected into the room. The next total solar eclipse worthy of our list was observed at sea by a Spanish admiral, Don Antonio Ulloa. His ship wasn't on an eclipse expedition. Its course simply intersected the path of totality. Talk about being in the right place at the right time. On June 24, 1778, he and his crew were heading to Cape St. Vincent from the Azores when they observed a totality lasting 4 minutes and 50 seconds. Of the sighting, Ulloa wrote, "The darkness was such that persons who were asleep and happened to wake thought they had slept the whole evening and only waked when the night was pretty far advanced. The fowls, birds, and other animals on board took their usual positions for sleeping, as if it had been night." By the way, this was the first total solar eclipse observed in the brand new country called the United States. The path made landfall in modern-day Louisiana, still then a French colony, where totality lasted 4 minutes and 31 seconds. It crossed into the U.S., then exited at the Atlantic coast of Virginia, after a totality that stretched to a whopping 5 minutes and 22 seconds. Before 1801, eclipse observations were largely descriptive in nature and primarily made to check the mathematical calculations of astronomers. It was during the 19th century, however, that science, mainly through the tools of spectroscopy and photography, entered the picture. The century's first notable total solar eclipse occurred June 16, 1806, and crossed the U.S. from Arizona to Massachusetts. The path of totality, whose length started at 3 minutes and 13 seconds and stretched to 4 minutes and 48 seconds, touched 21 states, or areas that would eventually become states. Observations on the center line from positions north of Wichita, Kansas, through the state of Massachusetts experienced more than 4 minutes of totality. While Plutarch described the corona he saw in 71 CE, it was Spanish astronomer José Joaquín de Ferrer who gave the sun's outer atmosphere that name after viewing the 1806 eclipse. He chose the word corona because it's the Latin word for crown. He was also one of the first observers who gave a convincing argument that this extended feature was part of the sun. Prior astronomers had debated whether it belonged to the sun or the moon. The annular eclipse of May 15, 1836, has an important place in history because an astronomer who observed it coined a term for a phenomenon millions of viewers had seen before and have seen since. English astronomer Francis Bailey experienced 4 minutes and 22 seconds of totality from Jedburgh, England. Like others before him, including Edmund Halley, who wrote of points on the moon's limb during a 1715 eclipse, Bailey described dots of sunlight often seen just before and just after totality, as well as during some annular eclipses. He called these points of light beads and explained that they appear because sunlight is passing through valleys located at the moon's irregular edge. These openings briefly let us see minuscule areas of the sun's surface. As a result of Bailey's observations and work, we now call that phenomenon Bailey's beads. The next total solar eclipse on our list, July 28, 1851, is important for two reasons. First, English amateur astronomer and author George F. Chambers wrote that it was the first that spawned dedicated eclipse expeditions. The path of totality stretched from what is today Western Canada to Ukraine. European astronomers, however, targeted Norway and Sweden. Bergen, Norway, and Gothenburg, Sweden, both major cities, experienced 3 minutes and 17 seconds of totality. The second reason this event is notable is because during the 2 minutes and 56 seconds the moon obscured the sun at the Royal Observatory in Königsberg, Prussia, a photographer named Johann Julius Burkowski took the first successful image of totality. He connected a camera that held a daguerreotype plate to a 2.4-inch refractor and made an 84-second exposure. During the total solar eclipse of August 18, 1866, two astronomers, Pierre-Jules César Janssen of France and J. Norman Lockyer of England, each independently discovered a new line in the sun's spectrum. Lockyer thought it showed an undiscovered element, which he named helium. In Greek mythology, Helios was the sun god. Although scientists would later show that helium is the second most abundant in the cosmos, it wasn't found on Earth for another 27 years. Also notable was the total solar eclipse of July 29, 1878, during which two groups of astronomers, while observed that more data could be gathered from higher altitude locations. An American group chose to watch the eclipse from the summit of Pikes Peak, which rises to 14,115 feet. A British group set up some 6,000 feet lower. Later, when their views of the corona were compared, those from the higher elevation were markedly better than the ones at the lower site because the air was much clearer at the former. The final total solar eclipse to mention is probably history's most famous because of its ties to Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity, which he published in full in 1916. The eclipse occurred 3 years later, on May 29, 1919, and the duration of totality, 6 minutes and 51 seconds, ranked it as one of the longest in the 20th century. Relativity proposed that space is curved by the mass of objects. To prove it, English astrophysicist Arthur Eddington led an expedition to the island of Princip off the west coast of Africa to photograph the sun during totality. If the theory were true, the sun's gravitational influence should shift the apparent position of nearby stars. Another scientific expedition with the same goal went to Sobral, Brazil. When both teams returned from their travels, three members, Eddington, Frank Watson Dyson, and Charles Davidson, authored the paper A Determination of the Deflection of Light by the Sun's Gravitational Field, from observations made at the total eclipse of May 29, 1919. In their conclusion, they state, "Thus the results of the expeditions to Sobral and Princip can leave little doubt that a deflection of light takes place in the neighborhood of the sun and that it is the amount demanded by Einstein's generalized theory of relativity, as attributable to the sun's gravitational field. It was an amazing confirmation of Einstein's theory. A virtual headache. Virtual reality is poised to transform the workplace, but strapping into a headset may come with consequences for your health. Virtual reality, or VR, is becoming more popular in corporate offices, thanks in part to the rise of remote work in the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic. VR headsets, wearable devices that immerse the user in a computer-generated 3D virtual environment, offer many potential employee benefits, from a more private and customizable virtual office to more engaging training sessions. By donning one of these high-tech headsets, personnel can immerse themselves in workplace simulations that might otherwise be cost-prohibitive, hazardous, or difficult to replicate. According to Deloitte, a consulting firm that's digging into the phenomenon, by 2024, around 25% of company meetings will include a virtual reality component. But this increase in virtual training is already driving up the numbers of hours employees wear a headset, causing many experts to become concerned about VR's potential pitfalls, particularly when it comes to physical health. The benefits of VR training may include completing training modules faster and a heightened emotional attachment to the material. In a recent survey on VR employee training, researchers found that employees progressed through the training modules 4 times faster than in person and 1.5 times faster than online. Additionally, the employees felt they had a stronger emotional connection to the lesson content, 4 times more than in-person courses and twice as much as learning online. Still, places adopting VR may have other motivations. It's living in the age of capitalism, says Jens Grubert, a professor at Coburg University of Applied Sciences and Arts in Germany. Companies do that because they want to save money, period. What's more, these companies may unknowingly jeopardize their employees' health when trying to cut costs. Like any technology, VR headsets can have potentially negative effects if used improperly or excessively. Researchers are increasingly worried that more time spent in a VR headset will exacerbate the symptoms shorter headset times already cause, like nausea, disorientation, or cyber sickness, the motion sickness that VR can cause, and other issues such as neck and shoulder strain. Alexis Choquet, a cognitive ergonomicist at the University of Southern California, says it's important to inform the public that hardware and software providers do little to assess the long-term risks of using VR. We don't have enough information on the risks for users to deploy these technologies at work within the 5 coming years, Choquet says. Using VR headsets may also cause users to experience eye strain. When using a VR headset, the pixelated screen is close to the eyes, which can tire eye muscles. Though most VR headset companies ensure their products' ergonomic design and comfort, there can still be issues with long sessions of headset use. With the current generation headset, the viewer experiences something similar to a 3D film. Your eyes focus on a certain distance, but converge on a different distance, which is unnatural, Grubert says. This can lead to cyber sickness and to different side effects. Unfortunately, most studies in VR's health-related side effects only look at usage under an hour. To address this knowledge gap, Grubert and his team had 16 individuals wear a VR headset for a full 40-hour work week, then repeat the same conditions, minus the headset, for a second week. Their study, published in IEEE Transactions on Visualization and Computer Graphics in 2022, was one of the first to look at the long-term effects of VR. The results revealed a concerning level of cybersickness, and 2 of the participants had to drop out after day 1 due to migraines, anxiety, and nausea. While the results from the study proved worrying, Grubert and his team believe that VR can still be used safely by employees for an entire 40-hour work week, so long as it's done responsibly. Limiting your use time to under 30 minutes per session is the easiest way, adds Choquet, who is not involved in the study. He recommends frequent breaks to avoid headaches. I would advise not to rush into using VR if your company didn't base its adoption on a rational assessment of the benefits and the risks by considering workers' health and safety. Dropping disruption. A new historical analysis reveals that published scientific research has been getting less and less disruptive over time. For years, scientists and other intellectuals have been lamenting that major innovations seem increasingly hard to come by. But until 2023, the extent to which this trend has infiltrated all of science and technology was unknown. Across 45 million papers and 3.9 million patents, a team of researchers found that from 1945 to 2010, the likelihood of any given paper being disruptive has declined across all fields of science and technology, even as the amount of scientific work published has increased. Publishing in Nature in January 2023, the researchers quantified scientific disruption using a metric that Russell Funk, sociologist at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management, developed in 2017. Using the vast web of citations that connect every publication in scientific literature, Funk's team scored every paper and patent on a scale from consolidating to disruptive, based on whether a paper usurps its predecessors in future citations or simply joins them. Though some are calling the innovation slowdown a wake-up call, the trend may be an emergent property of modern science. When so many papers are published, it's hard to break ahead of the pack. Scientists and inventors, the researchers found, are also citing older and less diverse work, and are more likely to cite their own work. The authors suspect this is a result of the deluge of new work published each day. There's an overabundance of new ideas that people have to keep up with, so people are responding by just focusing on a narrow stream of research, says lead author Mike Park, now assistant professor at the Organizational Behavior Department at INSEAD, an international business school headquartered in France. When scientists and inventors rely on less diverse work, they tend to produce less disruptive things. A number of additional factors likely drive the decline, like pressure to publish more papers and the increased difficulty for disruptive ideas to get funding and for such papers to pass peer review. There's also inertia in running a research program, both in terms of specialized knowledge and as well as supplies and lab equipment. I think people are stretched really thin, says Funk, underscoring how innovation often requires personal time and space to reflect or dig deeply into a problem. That's getting harder and harder to do these days. Still, it may be that all of this isn't worse for the pace of overall scientific breakthroughs, just different. Perhaps as humanity's understanding of reality expands, all fields become more granular. Incremental discoveries are also helpful and needed, notes Park. Yes, disruption is good, but sometimes fields just mature, he adds. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.